Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are about to have a conversation with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter about her book, The History of White People. She was the Edwards Professor of American History, Emerita, at Princeton University, author of many books, and it is just a pleasure to have her on the air. And Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I especially want to thank you because I know you were probably so talked out about this book.
No, I actually enjoy talking about it because different people have different questions depending on where they're coming from and what their interests are.
I was just teasing. I know you've been doing this a lot. It's an incredible book.
Thank you.
I wish at this point I was Stephen Colbert, though. Because
I don't see
that was a very funny 5 minute thing you did with him. He asked a very pertinent question though. When he started, his first question was, "Are you white?"
I thought, yeah.
Given the book, it was a pretty pertinent question.
Well, it was and it wasn't because the book is not about black white.
Right. Right.
It's not about. The usual discussion about race in the United States. It really is about differing conventions and views about who white people are. So since I'm not a white person and don't claim to be a white person, it was a kind of strange question.
It was a strange question, but you handled it well, I want to say. But
thank you.
I think that one of the things that really is fascinating about this, the whole idea of your attacking the subject and creating this work is that really in our Western canon, we write about every other race and categorize except for white people.
No, that's not exactly true. What I discovered was that there's tons of writing about white people. It's that body of knowledge has disappeared since we have come to focus solely on non-white people as race people. But I dedicated my book to the Princeton University Library, which is an incredible resource and has many, many hundreds more books on this subject than I could possibly read.
Well, what I meant by that was, I mean, when you write, and we'll jump into this a bit later, when you write about Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, and he really, I mean, he set the groundwork for defining race and included everybody from people who live in India to North Africa in the Caucasian race.
That's right. That's right. He didn't call it race, mind you. He called it varieties. He was writing in Latin, and he talked about varieties.
But when he did that, what I was trying to get to earlier was that it became after him kind of solidifying this growing knowledge of racial theory in our growth of racial theory that it everyone else shouldn't be defined over those years. Politically and socially, and the dominant kind of white culture of Europe gradually brought in almost every other European culture into the white race, even when they didn't consider them white in the beginning.
No, that's just not the case. We read that backwards because since the second half of the 20th century in the United States, we have a conception of one big white race. But if you go, say, to the 1920s or the 1930s, then you will find, in common parlance, the Jewish race, the Southern Italian race, and so forth. And those people were all considered white, but that's not all there was to it. They were within whiteness in the U.S. way, so they could vote if they were men. But they were also considered races. And when they were stigmatized, they were considered alien races. So our idea of just one white race is an idea that arose in the second half of the 20th century.
What I'm trying to put together here is all the things you wrote about in this book from beginning to end. And maybe I'm misreading what I read, but let me put it out there anyway. Is that in the context of the 19th century and the immigration into America, that these groups from the Irish in the 1830s and 40s to the Jews in the 1890s and early part of the 20th century and then Italians and Greeks were less than the rest of the white population.
They were less than Saxons. They were less than Nordics. They were less than Teutonics. So there are all these different – they were considered races within Europeans or within whiteness. And as you say, they were considered less than. They were considered racist.
So if you take this, but the way you kind of written this book and put it together, you take you bring us from the time of the Scythians and the Greeks to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really fascinating. A number of things is kind of were eye-opening in this book that I wanted to kind of ask you about. One was this we've been wrestling about race, especially in this second half of the 20th century since the Civil Rights Movement, redefining and trying to define what we mean by race. And keeps, mm-hmm. and it's one of our largest battles, I think, that America faces. But you go back to the time when, during Greece and Rome, and I hope I don't get this one wrong, that the Greeks, when they looked at other races that were even whiter than they, complexion-wise.
We don't know.
When you write about the Circassians, when you write about the Caucasus, uh-huh. when you write about the attitude they had about that beauty.
Yeah.
That's what I'm so when you're writing about that beauty, and you're writing about uh-huh. the way they looked at that was not like our race, but it was looking at a different culture.
You know, these are ideas. The Circassians and the Georgians and the Caucasians were considered supremely beautiful. And when Blumenbach used the word Caucasian for Europeans, he used it because it was because of the idea of beauty. But it wasn't an idea of beauty based on a particular body. It was a skull. So we have to start with a woman's skull, a sex slave's skull, actually, a woman from Georgia, a very young woman from Georgia. But the reason I went back to antiquity is because it's a very common view, even now, that the ancient Greeks were white people in the sense that we think of white people in the 21st or the 20th century. But the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans did not think in racial terms. Race was invented during the Enlightenment, during the 18th century. So it comes much, much later. When the Greeks looked around, they looked at how people lived and where they lived. We might say almost anthropologically, you know, what were their habits, what did they wear, that sort of thing. So skin color was not of great importance to them. So I honestly do not know if the ancient Greeks were different in skin color from, say, the Scythians or the Celts, people they thought of as Celts. It just was not as important a question for them as it was for those of us who lived after 1795.
And the way they looked at the issue of slavery had to do with a question of power and not a question of race.
They didn't look at slavery that hard. They took it for granted. Ancient Greece was a slaveholding society. They got their slaves from the Black Sea. It was just a fact of life. Aristotle wrote about slaves, and he wrote about slaves as though they were naturally slaves. And you would recognize his terms of discussion from 19th century American South writing about how the people who were slaves, it's because of them, and not because of what happened to them. So the idea that the people at the bottom deserve to be there because of something in them, that's a very old idea, and it isn't tethered to any particular race or culture.
When you write about Caesar's Gallic Wars, and you write about the kind of ruthlessness with which Caesar slaughtered the Gauls and
yeah,
the others.
Yeah, he was thorough.
I mean, left no Gaul standing, really. And the thousands of women and children that they were brought to slavery from that region to Rome.
Yes.
And what really hit me was that as well is that in that period that we talk about racial purity, but that was actually, and this is a great deal of racial, not racial, of ethnic mixing going on from antiquity.
Yes. You know, I think the impression that really hit me as I came away from finishing this book is what a constant migration is in human history. People have been moving since the beginning of people, And some of those migrations, like Caesar moving tens of thousands of people from conquered Gaul to Rome to finance his campaigns, that was people being moved against their will, or certainly involuntarily, just as the African slave trade was people being moved involuntarily. But moving people around, whether they want to or if it's their own idea, people have been moving, and people still move. People still move. So the idea that you can trace your lineage back hundreds of years, that you can find some pure source of identity, that's made up.
I wonder for you, when you write early in your book about how, I think one of the lines about citified men seem kind of the admiration they had for the tough barbarians. That it seems like there's almost a lineage from that to how we do two things. Maybe I'm two things. A is that it was almost the same way that Europeans looked at African slaves in some ways, admiring the strength, the power to enslave them, but also the sexualization of the barbarian as slaves. I mean, there was like a direct lineage in that kind of consciousness, it seemed to me.
Certainly it comes up over and over again, the idea that civilization will sap masculinity and that the men who do the hard work are stronger and therefore somehow admirable or even desirable because of that. We encounter that over and over again in different cultures and different times. Certainly, it comes up over and over again in Western writing. I am not an expert on non-Western writing, so I don't know if those ideas prevail in other places. But you do find it with the ancient Greeks. You find it with 19th century Americans. As you mentioned, and to a certain extent, I think you find it today in the movies.
What's fascinating to me, though, is how is this kind of connection that 18th century Europe has to antiquity in developing ideas about race, using that. I mean,
Germans especially connected themselves to the ancient Greeks, sometimes even fancying themselves as the physical descendants of ancient Greeks.
Right. And it seemed to me from Thomas Jefferson to the others and others you write about that the love of Rome, the love of antiquity, the love of that root of democracy was also the love of the root of justifying racial attitudes that began in the 17th and 18th century. Did you find that at all?
Yes. I think you may be oversimplifying, but even within the oversimplification, I think you have some good ideas there.
Well, I'm doing that because I want to try to kind of ferret out this idea for our listeners about the connections between the racial theorists of Germany and Europe and what they picked up from antiquity and what they thought they were picking up from antiquity.
Okay. There was lots and lots that they could have picked up from antiquity. They picked and chose what they wanted. So they had a certain reading of Caesar's Gallic Wars, and they had a certain reading of Tacitus. I tried to point out the things, even in those two documents, that they left out, so that you can, you trace backwards by picking and choosing and leaving certain things out and highlighting other things. So what I was trying to show was what was highlighted and what fell away. Over and over again, we find racial thinking or any kind of them and us or othering thinking making a pathway backwards to show a great and glorious lineage. But that really means choosing what you want to remember and what you want to forget.
We're talking this hour with Nell Irvin Painter, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University, who's written the book The History of White People. The lines are open at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com to join in this conversation with Nell Irvin Painter. about her book, The History of White People, 410-319-8888. I think one of the key figures here, and I'd like to spend some time with him, is Johann Friedrich Blumenbach.
Fascinating character.
My God. I never heard of him before your book.
Mm-hmm.
Almost in a sense, the founder of kind of the theory of race and racial superiority in the Western world.
No, he wasn't. He was the man who gave the name Caucasians to white people. Race theory has lots of parents.
I know that. But I meant that in his period in the 18th century, he seemed to lay the groundwork for a lot of stuff that came beyond him.
He is certainly considered the father of physical anthropology
because
he was so great a measurer of skulls.
Well, I know he's a great measure of skulls, but what I'm saying is that his theories seem to kind of help the underpinning of the theories he developed that justified a lot of our thinking about race in this country.
Yeah, the reason I'm holding back is that I don't want you to think of Blumenbach as the kind of racist thinker.
No, I wasn't saying that. No.
Because he actually held back from some of the more vicious thought that was going on around him. Remember, this was a time in which European scholars were trying to make sense of the world around them. So on the one hand, there was a kind of scientific interest in sorting out people. This is also the moment of the great upheavals of the revolutions, the U.S. Revolution and the French Revolution and the French ideas. And then when you get into the early 19th century, there's Napoleonic Wars and the way Napoleon's campaigns raised nationalist thoughts in the people he waged war against, including the Germans. So this is the roots of German nationalism as well. So there's a lot going on when Blumenbach was writing. But Blumenbach was a great scholar in physical anthropology, in measuring skulls, which is kind of the basis of physical anthropology. He's the man who added the word Caucasian to the European races. And he was a very thorough scholar who taught a lot of people who became influential in the world of scholarship. So, for instance, the brothers Humboldt were his students at Göttingen. So he was well-placed in the scholarly world, but he himself did not originate any kind of racial ranking. Blumenbach said a lot of things, and one of the things he said was that it's really difficult to draw lines between groups of people because differences in skull shape and color and stature and all that shade imperceptibly from one group to another. And he also had what we would call a black bibliophile's library. He kept collections of the writing of learned Africans. And that also was very unusual at the time for a European.
Let's open the phones here, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, the author of The History of White People. 410-319-8888, and Richard, on your cell phone, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Mark.
Hi, Richard, welcome.
Hi, and to your guests. I listened to your thoughts, and I'm in total agreement with you, because one of the things that's become quite clear is that merit meant so much more in a lot of cases. The transition from slavery to a higher place in society. And one other thing, you didn't mention the organized religion's impact on it. I don't believe I heard that anywhere on it. And I was wondering about that.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I did not
I'll get off the phone and hear your message, okay?
Thank you, Richard.
Okay. I did not go through organized religion's racial thinking for two reasons. One was that this was a whole area that I couldn't get into. I was following the more scholarly side. And the other is that most of that thinking, as I encountered it, was more on white people as colonists on the one hand, or as slaveholders on the other, slaveholders in the United States. So that was more white, non-white, than different views of various white people. Now, if I had been focusing on, say, Nazi Germany, then I would have had, I could not have avoided the whole question of where the churches stood on anti-Semitism and Nazism.
One of the things I was really shocked as I read this book, and let me just jump to this for a moment, we'll come back to some of the other issues that you raised in your book, was I was, again, having read Emerson, a lot of Emerson in my youth, I had no idea the role he played in terms of his own attitudes about race were pretty stunning to me.
Well, you know, so hard for us to conceive of a history of white race in the United States.
Right.
Those views of Emerson are not much read. I certainly had not even heard of English traits before I read this book. And I have encountered very, very few people who knew of it. But if you read English traits, there it is, Emerson's thinking about white race and about people he called Saxons, meaning people like him.
I mean,
Emerson had rather little to say about black people, but he had a lot to say about Saxons.
A lot to say about Saxons. Though the one thing he did say, you have this quote in here, you have this early musing you write, Emerson actually expels the Irish from the Caucasian race, and he writes, "I think it cannot be maintained by any candid person that the African race have ever occupied or do promise ever to occupy any very high place in the human family. Their present condition is the strongest proof that they cannot. The Irish cannot, the American Indian cannot, the Chinese cannot. Before the energy of the Caucasian race, all the other races have quailed and done obeisance." That's pretty... I mean, this is one of the father of our American letters.
He's a fascinating character. And, you know, I don't want to take anything away from Emerson.
No.
Emerson is the American Renaissance incarnate. He embodies so much of what's best in our 19th century letters. But he also had some ideas that have not worn quite so well. So we need to know more about Emerson, not less.
Well, you spent a lot of time on Emerson this book. I'm just curious about how you discovered that in your research and where it just took you after you finished this work on Emerson, these two chapters.
Well, I kind of backed into Emerson, and right now I don't exactly remember. I must have started with English traits.
Uh-huh.
And then reading English traits, I realized that I had to situate it in the scope of Emerson's thinking. You know, you can't just take a piece of somebody's thought and then blow it up and make a whole theory out of it. So I actually read most of Emerson's journals and Emerson's lectures and Emerson's essays. I read a lot of Emerson, and like most people who write over a lifetime, he contradicted himself back and forth. But what he had to say was really fascinating. And because he was so eloquent, what he said about Saxons really didn't lay the groundwork, because these were not original ideas, but he put into words, he put into shape an ideology that came to be called Anglo-Saxon, though he used the word Saxon.
And one of the things that really, I mean, I always knew about I've read a lot over the years about the Irish-Black divide and the dichotomy between the two cultures in the 19th century, leading into the 20th century even. But I when you write about Emerson, it becomes clear now, not clear, I mean, there's a potential here that in some ways maybe that vision of the Irish as not completely white when they got here is what drove them to become so pro-slavery in a majority of them.
That's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to that. But clearly, as in legal terms, Irish men were considered white enough to vote.
Right, right.
From the time they got off the boat, practically. In their time, in the middle of the 19th century, if you simply said you intended to become a citizen, in many places you could vote. So they were white enough to vote, but they were not Saxon. They were an inferior race that was white. They were Celts. They belonged to the Celtic race. And there's a lot of writing, very ugly writing, actually, stigmatizing Celts as stupid and brutish and ape-like and so on and so forth, ugly. I think a lot of the stereotypes applied to black people actually were originally evolved for Irish. Because remember, Ireland was an early British English colony.
Right, exactly.
And the ideology of oppression of the Irish was a racial oppression.
One of the interesting things in this thing as well that struck me were some people that I really, whose names I may have known from history but knew nothing about. I mean, we hear a great deal about Gustave de Beaumont, de Tocqueville's fellow traveler. But I've read de Tocqueville, but I've never read anything by de Beaumont until I got to try to find some more that he's done.
Beaumont did not flatter Americans the way Tocqueville did.
No, he did not.
And his thinking, I think we would see his thought much more as 20th century than 19th century. So even though he got a prize for his book in 1835, a French prize, the book was not translated until 1956.
So
hundred years later.
I mean, there were a series of people you talk about, several people you talk about from Europe who came and observed America and were really shocked and taken aback by the way blacks were treated and the whole environment of America. They were just not, I think, prepared for it.
You know what they were really, everybody was shocked at Americans tobacco spitting. I think that united travelers to the United States across their lines of ideology and politics. They were just appalled at Americans chewing tobacco and spitting.
We're going to take a very short break. We're going to come right back with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, The History of White People. Join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll reopen the phones and have you join this conversation with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org. Or the number for more information is 1-800-888-8823. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to mecu.com for more information. We are joined for the rest of this hour by Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, Edwards Professor of American History Emerita at Princeton University. Author of books like Sojourner Truth and Standing at Armageddon. We are talking about her latest work, The History of White People. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Did I read somewhere that you had said this would be your last book?
I may have said that, but I've gone back on that. I have one more book. It's called The Truth About Beauty.
The Truth About Beauty. And beauty.
Yeah, and I'm going to paint it, actually. It's going to have a lot of pictures and just a little bit of text.
You're going to do the painting?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So let's talk about beauty for a moment before we come into this transition in the growth of American whiteness in the 19th century. But the question of beauty was fascinating to me because, again, never before understood the role that artists played in Europe defining the power of whiteness and beauty.
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't just the artist. The artist, I think, I mean, art is about beauty. Beauty is about desirability, and so I think beauty plays a larger role in art than it does in science. But what I discovered that was something that I was learning as I was doing my research was that scientists considered beauty as a scientific trait. They would say, just to cinch their argument about how wonderful, say, the Saxons were, the Teutons were, something like that, they would say, and we are the most beautiful. Someone like Thomas Jefferson would cinch his argument about how beautiful Southern white women were by talking about the beauty of the blush, and mm-hmm. only they can blush. And that was a familiar line in the late 18th and 19th century, the blush as a kind of sign of female beauty.
And the idea that the artist painted this kind of white beauty that was actually enslaved white beauty.
I'm sorry, it was actually what?
The enslaved white beauty
the odalisque.
Right.
Odalisque means slave girl. And so over and over again, there are these great paintings. The most famous one, I think, is by Ang called Grande Odalisque, the Great Odalisque, which is of a young woman who could be French, but she is considered an odalisque, and she's shown, as Odalisque figures usually are, totally naked.
I mean, and so how do you think that those paintings affected the consciousness of those who would come later who admired those paintings in terms of what that role it played in the emergence of a standard of white beauty?
I think a lot of people in the late 20th century didn't know the meaning of the word odalisque. They didn't know it meant slave girl. And certainly the figure of the naked young woman mm-hmm. is of a nude, you know, which is a sort of a noble figure in art history. So she's not just a naked person, not just a naked woman. She is a nude, which is a kind of elevated figure. So you can look at a nude in a way that you can't look at a naked woman. A naked woman can be a figure of pornography, but a nude is a standard of beauty. So in the 19th century, for instance, the most famous piece of statuary was by Hiram Powers. It was called The Greek Slave. He did not use the word odalisque, but he used the actual word slave. And this was this larger-than-life-size white marble young girl, actually, who was wearing only a chain. And it went around, it traveled, and people swooned before it.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, her book, The History of White People, 410-319-8888. Scott in Laurel, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi, Scott.
I just have a question. The topic of looking at the culture of white people, are you making any correlations to the imagery that you see in history to today's social culture, specifically in America and Europe?
Yeah, I do come down to the present time. And over and over again, from the invention of races, that is in the late 18th century, into the present time, I say that the idea of white or the superior white races, like, say, the Saxons, or those that is, the races considered superior, that they were to embody beauty, wealth, leisure, knowledge, power, and so forth. So since throughout the 200 years, the term shift, depending on who's writing and whom they're talking to. So for some people, the idea of beauty is more important, and for others, the idea of manliness is more important.
And historically, I mean, if you just what Scott was saying, how do you see that playing itself out in the 21st century?
In the 21st century, we're in the shadow of the idea of one big white race.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot more is going on. And since we are no longer in the era of legal discrimination and legal segregation, a lot of people who are brown-skinned, whether they're immigrants or whether they're African-Americans, a lot of those people now have the perquisites that used to be only for white people, you know, education, power, beauty, wealth, and so forth. So I guess I say at one point that whiteness, being white, is not what it used to be. There's just a lot more going on in our culture.
You talk in, towards the end of the book about, in your chapter, I love these, the way you have phrased things, the enlargements of American whiteness. But you, in the fourth enlargement of American whiteness, you write about, you spend a couple pages talking about the census.
Yes.
Which seems to me in America now is in complete disarray. They don't know what to do.
Yeah, I would not like to be running the census and making sense of it or, you know, figuring things out. The census, but this is something that's been every 10 years, because the census answers to political questions. It says where people are for purposes of allotting congressional representation, and then it describes us. But the terms of description shift over time. So, for instance, in the early 20th century, when immigration was a big issue, and I say early 20th century, not early 21st century, early 20th century, white people were broken down by native white or immigrant white, and where parents were born, and I believe even some where grandparents were born. And then that disappeared as immigration was cut off in the 1920s, and generations of Americans were all native born. And then we've added new classifications in the racial ethnic area. Hawaiian was added in 1977 because the Hawaiians lobbied for a classification all their own. So these classifications shift, and they will continue to shift. I myself would rather see some collecting of statistics on wealth and income, because those are where I think public policy can make a difference.
And in many ways, the idea of the census was about public policy. I mean, at the civil rights movement,
it was about congressional representation. That
right,
was the first.
Right. And because when you talk about race, you get these really interesting statistics. I had this discussion on the way down to Washington about this one toward the latter part of your book, when you write, by 1990, American families were so heterogeneous that one-seventh of whites, one-third of blacks, four-fifths of Asians, and 19/20 of Native Americans were closely related to someone of a different racial group, and how that's just going to expand. Those are pretty interesting statistics. That's pretty phenomenal. I wonder what that says to you on a number of levels. I mean, one discussion I had, actually my fiancée was saying, well, perhaps that's because that this is such a white-dominated world that people who are not white are forced to interact with whites, and whites are not forced to interact with non-whites, at least for up into that period. Or why you think that these numbers are the way they are?
Well, one change, which I think your fiancé was pointing to, was that until the 1960s, it was legal to segregate people or expel them from the public sphere on the basis of race. And what that meant was that it was okay to discriminate in education, in housing, in jobs, in unions, and so forth. So the gradual lifting of those laws and those habits has meant that African Americans have been able to gain some upward mobility that simply was not possible in the age of segregation, and certainly not possible in the age of slavery. So with economic mobility, there's just been less stigma to blackness, but also in the 1960s, there was a thorough revision of immigration laws. And so we have lots and lots of immigrants now, largely people who are not from Europe and who do not consider themselves white. And in fact, the largest immigrant group is Latino or Hispanic. And there's always an asterisk to say that Hispanics or Latinos can be of any race. And large numbers of them, when they check Hispanic, they check other. So the categories are under tremendous pressure right now.
It'll be interesting to see how this census comes out. It'll be very interesting to see what happens when the census comes out. You lay, there's a really interesting modern historical perspective you lay, you posit about the role that Malcolm X played and the rise of the white ethnic identity. Talk about that. That was fascinating.
Uh-huh. Yeah. In the 1960s, Malcolm X was a great spokesperson for black power and black pride. And he also condemned white people for what they had done to black people. And he did not condemn, say, Mediterraneans or Alpines or Teutonics or Nordics. These were the terms for white people in the early part of the 20th century. He just talked about the white man. And so that idea of the guilty one white person, so to speak, undifferentiated mass, that was a very persuasive trope. Because Malcolm X was a very popular figure in the media. You know, he was very heavily covered. He was a very popular speaker. Only Barry Goldwater was more popular on campus.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, that you wrote that.
So
yeah.
He was the person who was listened to. And as he was accusing the white man, people who only had recently been welcomed as white people began to say, wait a minute, on the one hand, we're not guilty, but on the other hand, we're proud too. We're proud of what we are. So this wave of ethnic pride is an answer to black power and black pride. And in it, we have a resurgence of ethnic identity. Interestingly enough, Irish people don't always qualify as ethnic. You know, they're in or they're out as ethnics, whereas Jews and Italians and Slavs and Greeks and so forth always fall into the ethnic category. And certainly Scandinavians and Germans and English people are not considered ethnics.
Right. And I wonder where you think this will take us now. When you build the history here that you've built and kind of build the foundation of why of whiteness in the Western world, and we see the shift now here and in Europe in terms of the multiracial cultures being built and what's going to happen in America in this next generation. Things don't change overnight, obviously.
Right.
And if we have built up this sense over the last several hundred years of defining race, I'm curious what you think as a historian what this next generation might face in a world where
you already pointed to part of it, that we're just more and more mixed up.
Right.
But on the other hand, I am not saying that black white will disappear, because that's just fundamental to even the American Constitution. So, well, it's not fundamental in the words, but the idea is that there are some people who are three-fifths of a person, and that so many of our early leaders were slaveholders. You know, that ideology, that's going to be hard to budge. But so I think we will always have the idea of black as poor people, and embodying the stereotypes of poor people. Now, in the 19th century, the Irish were stigmatized in that same way because they were very poor people. But blackness, I think, will continue to function as a sign of poverty. And at the same time that the realms of beauty and power and wealth will become more and more heterogeneous. So in a sense, we could say we're moving toward a black, non-black. And non-black will be large and heterogeneous and consist of people of many different colors. But black will still be poor people.
And black will still be poor. Now what about but what about Latinos in America? Mexicans, Puerto Ricans?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's the short answer. I don't know. You know, in one scenario, they shake out as some of them become not black and some of them become black, depending on how their fortunes fall. And in another scenario, they completely outmold our old black-white dichotomy and really forge a new way of thinking, perhaps not even a race way of thinking. I don't know. I'm a historian. I look backwards. I don't look forwards. And that book was so much work. Please don't ask me for another volume.
Well, let me go back to you. Let me go back to the volume then. Let's see if we can, as we wind towards the end here. As a historian, and you look at the social and political turmoil we have here in the early part of the 21st century, and you think about men you've written about who I was just fascinated by like William Z. Ripley.
Yes.
To talk a bit about him, and also in terms of, if you could, a bit about him and how this kind of intellectual framework in some ways, it seems to me, lays the foundation for race thinking in the 20th century.
You're absolutely right. A man named William Z. Ripley, who published an extremely influential book called The Races of Europe, Races Plural of Europe, in 1899. When he wrote it, Ripley was teaching at Columbia University. The book did very, very well and got him a professorship at Harvard. That book schematized for the first quarter of the 20th century the three European races. And those three races were Teutonic, who were long-headed and light-colored, Alpines, who were round-headed and brownish, and Mediterraneans, who were long-headed and dark. Now, a lot of people were left out of this, notably Jews, and he had trouble with Jews. He said, Jews are not a race, they are a people. But Jews had been a problem, also Laps had been a problem for the racial thinkers from the early in the 18th century. But anyway, so his three races, his three European races were Teutonic, Alpine, and Mediterranean. And he based that on pigmentation and on skull measurement. So there were two different kinds of skulls. One was brachycephalic, which was round-headed, which was bad, and one was dolichocephalic, which was long-headed, which was good if you were light-eyed and light-haired and light-skinned. And this category, this three-way category, went right into the First World War era and into IQ testing, and into the stigmatization of the poor immigrants, working-class immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. So, actually, I think Ripley got the job of making some kind of sense of this hodgepodge of racial thinking in order to lay the groundwork for cutting off immigration. His mentor, Francis Amasa Walker, great American
right.
Economist, was rabidly anti-immigration, rabidly opposed to the Southern and Eastern Europeans.
What really is interesting to me and shocking throughout this book is the intellectual power that existed and still exists today, actually, I think, but existed in making these arguments about racial purity and race and defining race and dividing race. And
I think that surprised me, too, that so many people who were so well-placed, I mean, even somebody like Theodore Roosevelt,
right,
who felt so strongly about, and this is not black-white race, about the different white races and their ranking and what he called the warfare of the cradle. And why didn't his kind of people have more babies while the hooligans and the sun and shines and so forth were having too many babies and so forth. So people at the very top of our society were purveying some pretty tough ideas.
And I just have to think that some of that just seeps into American consciousness as part of who we are.
Absolutely. They were shining a green light.
And in some ways, even though people don't see the green light, I still think it's there.
Well, I don't think they can understand. I mean, maybe it's not a good metaphor. But certainly, this kind of stuff was being taught all over the United States. And just the other evening, I was having a discussion. I was in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Virginia is where Carrie Buck was sterilized involuntarily. Her case went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1925, and the Chief Justice said that it was okay to sterilize her because three generations of imbeciles were enough.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a stigmatization of poor white people. And I should say, poor white people who were as Anglo-Saxon as they could be, but they were considered degenerate families. They were considered mentally defective.
We only have a few minutes left, but I'm glad there's another historical strain in America that also vies for the conscience of our country in developing who we are. And you write a whole chapter on Franz Boas,
yes.
The great dissenter.
Mm-hmm. And Franz Boas and his students actually set the terms for how we thought about race in the late 20th century. So it was Boas and his students who said, no, there are not many white races. There's only one. That's the Caucasoid. And then there's one, which is Mongoloid. And there's another one, which is Negroid. There are only three races. There are three races, they said. Races really exist, and there are three of them. But there's only one white race. And that was the reigning idea from about the Second World War, certainly the latter part of the 20th century. And I think that's the one that most Americans carry around in their heads today.
And we're pretty much out of time, but we never got a chance to be able to get into the end of your book where you start talking about when you delve into the world of genetics, which is a very complex world.
Yeah.
I mean, between genetics saying there's no difference between races to finding things like the Kohanim gene. I mean, that set up a lot of contradictions for people.
Well, you know, the idea that race is not a scientific concept, that is not just with the genome. That's not just genetics.
Right, right,
that was
right.
Clear from the middle of the 20th century. And anthropologists wrote against it and said, you know, race is a myth. The idea of race is as mythological as the idea of witchcraft. But we have to keep relearning that lesson.
This has been just a pleasure. I look forward to Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, your next book, your painted book.
Okay, good. Thanks so much, and thanks for letting me talk about the Gauls and the Scythians, too.
I loved it. This is a wonderful history, one of the really lovely, well-written, really accessible. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, the book, The History of White People. We are going to take a very brief break, and after the top of the hour, we are going to come back and be joined by none other than John Waters, who's written a new book called Role Models. We'll find out who his role models are and why. Stay with us. We'll be right back.